Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Yesterday was election day for municipal offices in Charlotte, city council races, and for that, for the mayor. They were all on the ballot in a contest usually marked by low voter turnout. This time, however, early voting indicated more people going to the polls than in the past in an election that will decide who will run in November and, in some cases, who will gain or retain seats on council even before that election. We're going to go through all of the results of yesterday's votes, examine the place local elections hold in our current political landscape, and how the timing of those elections can often affect turnout a little bit later on. But first, we must spend some time on an event that happened several weeks ago when a 23-year-old Ukrainian immigrant, Irina Zarutska, was stabbed to death on a Lynx Blue Line train in South End near the Camden Road station. In the aftermath, several city council members expressed concerns about Kat's safety precautions. The mayor sent thoughts and prayers to the woman's family and friends. But since that time, city leaders have been relatively quiet, and now the incident is receiving national attention. Just days ago, in a video statement from the Oval Office, Donald Trump made this statement.
For far too long, Americans have been forced to put up with Democrat-run cities that set loose savage, bloodthirsty criminals to prey on innocent people, really very, very innocent people. In every place, they control radical left judges, politicians, and activists, and they've adopted a policy of catch and release for thugs and killers. In Charlotte, North Carolina, we saw the results of these policies when a 23-year-old woman who came here from Ukraine met her bloody end on a public train.
Crime, as we all know, is a focus of the Trump administration, and he has sent National Guardsmen and troops to Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, and Chicago with the promise to send them to other cities in the future. And yesterday, the United States Department of Justice federally charged the alleged attacker, with Attorney General Pam Bondi promising to seek the maximum penalty for this unforgivable act of violence, her words also saying, quote, he will never see or never again see the light of day as a free man. Because this is now national, even international news, and because we haven't heard much from city leaders about this, we invited the mayor, Kat's interim CEO Brett Cagle, and CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings to appear on this program today. All declined. But later in the hour, we will hear from Mecklenburg County DA Spencer Merriweather to discuss crime and the workings of law enforcement and the judicial system and the role they have played and can play in reducing crime. Meanwhile, WFAE political reporter Steve Harrison has been covering this extensively for us, and he joins us now. Good morning, Steve. First of all, this happened on the Blue Line on August 22nd. For those who may not be familiar because they were on vacation or something, recap briefly what happened.
So it was the night of August 22nd, a little before 10 p.m., and the video that Katz released, the surveillance video from inside the train, shows Irina Zarutska getting on the light rail, sitting down in front of DeCarlos Brown. A few minutes pass by. He then stands up, he pulls out a pocket knife, stands up from behind her and stabs her in the neck. She falls over. She dies on the scene in this horrific killing. I think what added has kind of raised this story to national and international levels are two things. One is the release of that video that I just talked about a week ago. When people saw this with their own eyes, there's just a level of fear and rage that you don't get from just reading a story about it. And I think another thing that kind of coupled with that was people went back and looked at Mayor Lyles's original statement on the killing, which really focused on compassion for people with mental illness and people who are homeless and kind of asking the community not to judge them with a broad brush. And people felt like that statement did not give... just did not hit the right notes in terms of of what happened.
Yeah, it was horrific. It's unspeakably horrific. And I don't know what you really can say in the face of that, but city leaders have been quiet, and they've been quiet even after this has gained national and international attention. Should they have anticipated this kind of outcry over this incident? And are they being transparent enough in this incident? Is this the way to handle something like this?
Well, I will say that CATS, the transit system, released that video through a public records request. They put that out themselves. I think that was a very transparent act to let people see what happened. And the city initially did hold, they held a Metropolitan Transit Commission meeting about their new safety plan. The city council discussed it. But as the furor has mounted worldwide, they have now kind of retreated and are not speaking about this.
As we heard in that clip from Donald Trump a few seconds ago, obviously crime is one of the key cornerstones, tent poles of his administration, and he has characterized and painted with a very broad brush a hellish landscape in the United States, particularly in Democratic-controlled cities where crime is running rampant and you can't go outside. None of that is true, but that this incident has also provoked U.S. Secretary of Transportation Sean Duffy to post a statement on X saying, quote, "The Democratic Party at every level judged politicians, judges, politicians, academics, nonprofits is organized around the defense and protection of the criminal, the monstrous, and the depraved." Is that hyperbole, or is there a scintilla of truth to any of that?
Obviously, I think there's a tremendous amount of hyperbole in that. But among Republicans and conservatives, there's been a frustration and a belief for a long time that over the last 10 years, there has been, in terms of criminal justice, a movement toward policing with a lighter touch, a movement to eliminate or reduce cash bail. So there is some truth in that there has been a movement over the last 8 or 9 years toward criminal justice reform, and Republicans and conservatives believe it has had negative consequences.
And Sean Duffy, the Secretary of Transportation, went on to say that Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles doesn't want the media to show you the ugly truth, apparently referring to her social media post thanking the media for their discretion locally for not, some of them did not show the tape or the stills. Couldn't the same thing be said of our not showing video of these violent school shootings? Because it seems to me that if you did show that video, the reaction would be similar to this, maybe worse.
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement. And I think it's important to remember that, I mean, there's been talk about Republicans politicizing this murder. I think it's important to remember, Mike, as you just talked about, in the case of school shootings, Democrats immediately move to talk about gun control, and you know, Republicans kind of pivot to talk about mental health. And I think constituents and voters want their leaders, I mean, they want them to politicize this. They want change. They want efforts. Just as Democrats want gun control in the wake of school shootings, Republicans want tougher policies on crime in the wake of something like the Lynx Blue Line murder.
One of the early reactions to this shooting was on the part of many on city council was how this might affect the voters going to the polls in November to vote yes or no on the sales tax referendum to expand our transit system. And Sean Duffy, the Secretary of Transportation, will play, one would presume, a key role in any federal government deliberation over awarding our city billions of dollars in grants for light rail if voters approve this plan. Does anyone have any idea of the likely impact on the administration of this, either the president or Sean Duffy or Stephen Miller? And I add Stephen Miller to the list because he made a social media post blaming Democrats at every level, judges, politicians, academics, nonprofits, for working to protect and enable the defense of the monstrous and depraved.
I think one of the questions will be, let's say if the tax does pass in November, the timeline, you know, these transit projects move so slowly. CATS won't be going to ask the federal government in 6 months or a year for billions of dollars. So we might have a whole new administration by then. But in just speaking of the transit sales tax, all of the things that have come out there's so many investigations going on now. Sean Duffy, you just mentioned, he's launched an investigation into cats' safety procedures. Others are talking about proposing legislation. This is going to be in the news for a long time. I mean, this is not just going to burn out this week.
And evidently, the state auditor is getting involved with an investigation as well. The Charlotte-Mecklenburg Fraternal Order of Police, and we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, posted a statement on Facebook following the city council meeting that came in the aftermath of this, at which several members expressed concerns over transit safety and over how this might impact the referendum in November. And the FOP posted a statement on Facebook reading, "To Charlotte voters, do not be fooled. We need new leadership starting at the top." And they criticized the mayor for coddling the man responsible and asserting that she should have spoken about the lack of resources the city provides for serious mental health issues. Of course, this was in advance of an election that the mayor soundly won, and we'll talk about that later in the program. But is mental health a city responsibility? Isn't that a state and county responsibility?
Yeah, that is not in the city's wheelhouse, something that they do. The mayor, on, I believe it was on Monday of this week, issued a new statement after the first two that she made on social media were so thoroughly criticized. And in that, she put the blame on the judicial system, on Mecklenburg judges and magistrates, whom she said are letting criminals, you know, catch and, I don't know if she used the words catch and release, but essentially catch and release. And the FOP responded and said, look, we have been complaining about this for years, and we were met with crickets that you did not respond to us and bring it up, et cetera. Now, this is a difficult thing because the judicial system is not under the purview of the mayor, but it's all a system that kind of works together, and you will see governments bring in, invite other governments for summits and roundtables, et cetera, to try and talk about problems. And in the last 5 or 6 years or so, the Charlotte City Council and the mayor, it's just not something they've been particularly interested in talking about. I don't remember this being an issue that they've brought everyone together. So,
DeCarlos Brown is the alleged perpetrator of this incident. He was almost immediately arrested by police because he was standing on the train platform when they arrived. Yesterday, he was federally charged with terrorist attacks or other violence against a mass transit system. And that's in addition to the local charges he faces of first degree murder. But previous to this, he had several interactions with CMPD's Community Policing Crisis Response Team where he was, quote, referred to available resources. What does that mean?
That is a good question, Mike, in terms of what happened in 2025. I believe it was in January he was arrested for misuse of a 911 system. The police at the time noted concerns about his mental stability. In July, a judge ordered a competency evaluation, but it wasn't completed and he remained free. I think this is a difficult one because the arrest earlier this year for misusing the 911 system is a misdemeanor. That is a difficult, I guess what I'm saying, it's not a clear-cut situation where he was, say, arrested for armed robbery and then released without bail. I mean, that did not happen in 2025.
And because he's charged locally with first-degree murder and charged federally with terrorism, which trial takes precedence over the other? Which will occur first?
I wish I had enough legal knowledge on that one to know which train is going to arrive at the station first. I don't know that one.
Maybe we'll ask that of Spencer Merriweather, our Mecklenburg County District Attorney, because he will be on here in just 90 seconds to talk more about how we approach crime and the prosecution of crime and the challenges faced by the judicial system in Charlotte, Mecklenburg, and throughout North Carolina. When we come back, it's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking this morning. We'll recap the election results from last night and to talk about other things that surround our local elections. But we are recapping what's going on with that case of the stabbing on the Blue Line that has now erupted into national and international coverage. And yesterday, the U.S. Department of Justice federally charged the attacker, DeCarlos Brown, with terrorism. Russ Ferguson is the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of North Carolina.
More than 150 people move here every day. We built a city that people want to live in, but we can lose that all if we allow violent crime like this to go on in our streets. And I'm here to tell you, the federal government is going to save our city from that.
He became emotional during his press conference yesterday. We're joined now by Spencer Merriweather, who's Mecklenburg County's district attorney. Steve Harrison is still with us. Thank you for being here this morning. We appreciate it. Which case will take precedence, the federal case or the local case, Spencer, of charges of first-degree murder?
Mike, let me start by saying this. Obviously, my thoughts for the last 3 weeks have been with Irina Zarudzka, her family, after what was a vicious murder in Mecklenburg County in the city of Charlotte. At this time, there is a first-degree murder case in North Carolina courts. That is a case in which we are currently proceeding on. That case is being handled by state prosecutors. There's a lot of discussion, and I know a lot of inquiry about this. We are in a place where we have to do our talking about this case in a court of law. So that means that there's not going to be a lot I'm going to be able to discuss with you.
Right. I understand that. But which case takes precedence? Which will go first?
What I can tell you is that right now we have both the defendant and the case is with the state, and we intend on proceeding.
Okay. The suspect in this murder, DeCarlos Brown, has been arrested more than a dozen times before, I think 14 times. He appears to have a history of mental health issues and has been charged with numerous crimes in the past, including felony larceny, robbery with a dangerous weapon, and communicating threats. And the Observer reports that, quote, almost all of those charges were dropped. I know you can't talk about this case specifically, but I think you can talk about him and his past situations. Why is someone who has been arrested a dozen times or more on the street?
That I want to correct you. It actually is wrong that I can talk about the defendant. I've got to be the rules of professional conduct.
Well, in general, why would a person who has been arrested 14 times with the charges dropped?
I can give you some context first. I can tell you that this is someone who actually served a 5-year sentence for armed robbery. He was prosecuted in this county by this office. I will note that I can say that because that's something that's already been published and it's something that you could look up yourself. So I feel comfortable proceeding that way. I could tell you that since a number of years, I have been someone who has championed the fact that we need to make sure that we're taking pretrial release seriously. I've called on all members of our court system to make sure that they're thinking about victims and neighborhoods when they are considering whether or not someone should be released. That is best evidenced by the fact that it was in Mecklenburg County that we proceeded to go to the General Assembly to ask them to pass the Pretrial Integrity Act. You'll remember that a whole list of folks who commit violent crimes that we made it so that judges are the ones that hear their bond hearings in open court so that victims can be heard from. That if people are repeat offenders, even on lesser crimes like misdemeanors, that if they already have a charge pending, that they can be held. Yes, there are things that we want to do to make sure that people can be held in custody when they pose a danger. It's also true that in this state, and quite frankly across this country, there are a lot of people who are suffering from mental illness, who may not actually commit the most serious crime in the world to get before a judge, but at the same time, they do pose a threat to public safety, even if there hasn't been a crime committed.
When somebody, and the mayor and others, have alluded to the fact that the alleged perpetrator of this incident has mental health problems or has had them in the past. What are the laws surrounding those with mental health issues who also commit crimes or threaten other people with crimes? What can prosecutors and courts do and not do?
Well, there's a couple things. First of all, when an officer in the street or even a civilian interacts with someone who they believe is going to be a threat to themselves or a threat to others, there's obviously a civil procedure called involuntary commitment, but that is a high standard. If for some reason that high standard is not met and someone sees that criminal activity is afoot, someone's committed a violation of criminal law, then at that point, they will go before the court. If there is some suggestion to the court that this is someone who's suffering from mental illness, and usually the first way that that manifests itself is through their conversation with their defense counsel. And their defense counsel may very well ask whether or not, or whether that person can be evaluated to see whether they have the mental capacity to stand trial. That's usually the first question that we have to face when proceeding with prosecutions. That can take a while. I can tell you that locally it takes a lot less time than it used to because there are some local forensic evaluation programs, which has shortened some of that time. But there is a significant backlog of folks. What I want to make sure that I'm stressing with you, however, is that whether or not there are serious crimes that are committed, misdemeanors that are committed, or no crime at all, there still continues to be a terrible mental health issue around not only in this county, but across the country, where there are a lot of people walking the streets who still pose a threat to public safety. And there isn't, especially in this jurisdiction, there's not the kind of facilities, there's not the kind of infrastructure that we need in this community in order to be able to treat that and to make sure that we're keeping our entire community safe from folks who pose a threat to public safety.
So mental health and the availability of treatment is one problem. The other problem is that we do have in this jurisdiction and around the country, evidently, evidence of repeat offenders being out on the streets when perhaps some people would think they would they should be in jail. And this is how Donald Trump referred to this incident and the problem of criminals on our streets, even after multiple arrests during his recent video posts.
She was slaughtered by a deranged monster who was roaming free after 14 prior arrests. We cannot allow a depraved criminal element of violent repeat offenders to continue spreading destruction and death throughout our country. We have to respond with force and strength. We have to be vicious just like they are. It's the only thing they understand.
What's your response to his remarks and his suggested approach to solving this problem?
My response is that in this office, that we have given special concentration in the way that we have proceeded against people who are repeat offenders and habitual felons, of using enhanced sentences to try to keep this community safe, and using the evidence that we have and partnering with law enforcement to make sure that we're holding people accountable. What it takes to have that happen is the strength of law. Where those enhancements exist, we use them. It takes evidence. Where that evidence exists, we use them. And we will use them to keep this community safe. But that does not absolve us of our responsibility to make sure that we are following the law. That does not absolve us of our responsibility to make sure that prosecutors are going into a court of law, making the arguments that the public expects from us. We will continue to do that. That is a responsibility that I've had as a prosecutor in this office for over 18 years, going on 19. And that's the very responsibility and obligation that I will hold going into this next year.
Here's something else that Trump said during that recent video release.
24 of the top 25 most dangerous cities in America are run by Democrat mayors. And it's time to stop this madness. The people of our country need to insist on protection, safety, law and order. We'll do what has to be done because we're going to make America safe again. And that includes our big cities. We're going to make those cities safe.
It is true that 24 of the top 25 most populous cities are run by Democratic mayors, a list that Charlotte is on. But we are not on the list of the 30 U.S. cities that have the highest number of crimes. Yet he made that assertion when talking about us. Is he helping or hurting your efforts with comments like those?
My job and what I ask of all of the prosecutors that work in our office, what I will ask of the 11 prosecutors that will start in this office who just passed the bar exam over the next few weeks, is that they keep their eye on the ball, they keep their hand on the plow, that they are focusing on the task at hand and not on politics, not who's a Democrat and a Republican. Because I can assure you that when a victim's family that has lost a loved one walks into this office, I am not asking them what party they belong to, and they sure aren't asking me. And so we want to make sure that we are concentrating on how it is that we're going to keep this community safe, how we're going to keep the public safe, and how we're going to make sure that they can depend on the law to keep them safe.
The mayor has received a lot of criticism about the way she and others on council have handled this incident. But recently she stated that this murder on the Blue Line, quote, was a tragic failure by the courts and magistrates. Our police officers arrest people only to have them quickly released, which undermines our ability to protect our community and ensure safety. That's a quote. You've spoken about this on this program in the past as well, and you've said that the courts are overburdened and underfunded, as is your office, the district attorney's office. How much of the problem that we face is due to the fact that stems from that, that the courts can't handle the load, nor can your office?
Without commenting on the actual, the killing of Irina Zaruzka, I can tell you, just as I have told you the many times that I've been on this program, we do not have what we need to govern and to uphold law in a city of this size and complexity. That's just the truth. Since 2010, this county has grown by 20%. We have a single prosecutor that's been added to the district attorney's office. Now, I will tell you, over the course of the last year, the General Assembly and both the House and the Senate decided that we needed at least 10 more. Now, they haven't come to an agreement yet on their budget, so that is not resulting in 10 more prosecutors for this office. But they understood the problem. And so we need to make sure that we are doing more, not just for prosecutors, but quite frankly, for judges, for courtrooms, magistrates. We are still in a system where just last year, the salary for magistrate judges just got raised to $56,000. They still do not have to be attorneys, which I think most people, when they find out that that's a reality, think that's crazy, especially in a city, again, with our complexity and facing the kind of challenges that we do.
And a lot of times, if I understand the system correctly, and correct me if I'm wrong, please, magistrates are the ones deciding whether or not an accused defendant can be released on bond or have to serve some time in jail while awaiting trial. And last year, a WBTV report indicated that magistrates, they kind of back up what you just said, magistrates in the state, not just here, have few qualifications and little oversight, but more power than similar judicial officials in other states. Is that the case?
What we try to do with the Pretrial Integrity Act is make sure that we brought this stuff into the light of day. It's not just the fact that it's someone without a law degree who's making that decision. It's also the fact that it happens in the basement in a lower level of a detention center or a jail, that we want to make sure that victims are heard from. We want to make sure that prosecutors, quite frankly, are heard from. We want to make sure that that police officers, law enforcement officers are heard from, and that currently isn't happening under our system. So if there's an opportunity out of all this to actually bring some a new level of review to how our systems work, I'm all for it. I should also say that this is not a time to be pointing the finger. The only person I want to point a finger at is someone who actually has committed a crime. In the meantime, I'm willing to link up with whatever partners I can, be they federal, be they state, be they local, be they city, county, or whatever, Democrat or Republican. We know what our community expects from us on public safety. We want to make sure that we meet up with our partners however possible.
Governor Josh Stein has called for more cops on the beat in reaction to this crime. Is that the solution? I mean, if prosecutors have to triage which cases they take to court because of backlogs, and the backlog at the court can result in people taking years to get to trial, is more cops on the beat the problem or the solution?
I can't say this simply enough. It is everything, Mike. We are the 14th, 15th largest city in America. You need more prosecutors, judges, police officers. If we are going to be the kind of city that has this kind of complexity, we are going to need more of everything, because certainly we have had to do without. I've told you before that probably a good fourth of my office is funded not by the state, even though it's that's the responsibility. It's funded at a fraction of what the rate is for prosecutors by our city and our county, not even their job. And so if the state of North Carolina If as we grow, as we become more complex, we are going to have to be in a place. We're going to have to be in a place where we're actually having the staffing that we need at every level: police, prosecutor, judges, the whole nine yards.
And State Senate Leader Phil Berger posted on social media this week that it's time to put our soft-on-crime DAs, judges, politicians, and sheriffs on notice. Their embrace of lawlessness in the name of equity will not be tolerated. It should be pointed out that Phil Berger is a Republican. He's talking about you and others. What's your response?
I've got 19 years in this as a prosecutor. I didn't join and do this for politics. I've worked for a Democrat. I've worked for a Republican. My values have remained the same, even though the world around us has changed in a number of different ways. And the reason why it hasn't changed is because I know that at the end of the day, I'm going to find myself in a room with a family. I'm going to find myself in a room with a victim and have to be able to talk explain to them all of the challenges that we will face in a criminal justice system and all that we are going to try to do to overcome that. So whatever sort of accusations come from other folks, I just want to make sure I'm keeping my attention focused on the task at hand.
In Chicago, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker says that if the Trump administration wants to get serious about stemming violent crime, they should release the hundreds of millions of dollars of grant money to fund police that they are holding back. And here in North Carolina, Senate Leader Phil Berger and House Speaker Destin Hall, both Republicans, have promised to keep citizens safe and help law enforcement go after violent criminals. And yet both the Senate and the House have yet to agree on a budget which has raises for law enforcement and more money for things like the judicial system. That's all in limbo. Is money for police the issue here, or is it money for the court system that is the issue here?
I think we need to think a little bit broader. It's money for police. Yes, it's money for prosecutors, but it's also money for everything. If you fail to fund a healthcare system, if you fail to have the resources that you need for mental health, if you fail to have the institutions that you need necessary to make sure that you are keeping people secure from people who have mental illness, who present a public safety problem, you will have more need for prosecutors and more need for police. You know, I always say that we are sort of a down or an upstream sort of system as far as the criminal justice system is concerned. There are other failures that happen other places that we end up having to actually deal with. Now, I've taken on that responsibility. Every prosecutor in this country has taken on that responsibility, just as law enforcement has. But when we fail to properly resource so many of our sectors, this is what we can expect. We've got to do something about it.
Spencer Merriweather is the longtime district attorney in Mecklenburg County. I want to thank you for coming on the program this morning when others in city government declined our invitation. I appreciate your time. When we
Thanks,
come
Mike.
Back, we'll talk about the election results from yesterday's election and more. So stay with us. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, home ownership, and critical home repair. More information at HabitatCharlotteRegion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. As promised, we're going to spend the rest of the hour recapping yesterday's primary in Charlotte's municipal elections. WFAE political reporter Steve Harrison stays with us. We're also joined for some perspective on the role and importance of local elections to our democracy by Dr. John Lappe, Associate Professor of Political Science at Plymouth State University in New Hampshire, who just so happened to get his doctorate from the University of North Carolina. And in the interest of full disclosure, as we talk about one of these races on the city council, one of the candidates in District 5, Juan Diego, or J.D. Mazuris Arias, is the partner of WFAE staff member Julian Berger, who is not involved in any coverage of District 5 or of the city council. Dr. Lappe, thank you for joining us this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Steve, let me start with a recap of what happened yesterday in the elections. Early voting started slow, but by election day, more people had voted early than at any time since 2017. What was the final vote total? Did it turn out to be larger than expected?
Yeah, the final turnout last night was 8%, which is much higher than 2023, which was 5%, which was really, really low. I look back, the 8% is kind of a historic level. I think that's what it was in 2017 and 2015. So still really, really low. And because Charlotte has partisan elections for the city, which is very unusual, most of the races were decided last night, essentially, yeah, with 8% turnout.
Dr. Lappe, is that normal for municipal elections to have an 8% turnout and for 8% to be high?
Yeah, for a primary election, and partisan elections are somewhat unusual. About 30%, best we can tell, of local elections in the U.S. are partisan. The vast majority are nonpartisan. But 8% turnout for a off-cycle, meaning odd-year primary election, no, that does not surprise me. If anything, it actually is kind of on the high side. 8% would be low, but not unheard of even for a competitive general election in an off-cycle election. And of course, being partisan and Charlotte being a big, mostly Democratic city, yeah, you know, most usually the election would just be decided in the primary. So no, not unusual at all for single digit voters to decide the outcome and who controls the city.
I've asked many times of people who control when our election cycles are why we do it this way. Why not put the municipal elections along with the midterms or with the presidential cycle? No one has been able to give me a really good answer, but could one of the answers be that these candidates would get lost in the fray?
Yeah, that's a serious risk. So the research I did with Professor Melissa Marshall of Rice University, and it was just confirming what other studies have already found, is turnout is for election for mayor is about 10% higher in a midterm versus off cycle, about 25% higher in presidential versus off cycle. And so, yeah, an easy way to actually increase the percentage of people who are selecting the mayor or the council would be to simply move the election on cycle. There are the assumption, and this hasn't really been tested in academia, but the assumption by a lot of people is that, well, these elections could very well get lost in the shuffle if people are going out to vote for Kamala Harris or Donald Trump, that they may see an election for mayor or city council and not know who the candidates are. Right. For some offices, maybe not even know what the office does. So off cycle, you hopefully get people who, you know, they're brought to the polls by the local election. Presumably they're somewhat informed on it. As for why this happened, this was actually a progressive era reform. So late 19th, early 20th century is really when the move to off cycle elections kind of began as a widespread movement. And the argument made by progressives at the time basically was this will increase the percentage of people who know about city politics or town politics who are voting. That was the argument that they made. The other reality was that they figured that their voters tended to be higher education, more likely to vote no matter when the election was. So they also kind of did it because they just figured their candidates were more likely to win if it was off cycle.
But voter turnout is traditionally low in these municipal off-year elections. And in our case, in Charlotte, most of the incumbents have now been reelected. We'll talk about that in a second. And many times it's the usual suspects who are running and who win in these elections. Is that part and parcel of why we have low voter turnout? Because no, people know that it's a shoe-in? Or is it a shoe-in because we have low voter turnout?
Yeah, it's a vicious reinforcing cycle, most likely. Actually, you know, we found that about half of local elections in the U.S. are uncontested. That's less likely in a major city. You're more likely to get somebody to actually run. But about half of U.S. local elections, there's just one candidate running, and you really don't have any incentive to come out and win. And, you know, that's just uncontested. That's not even counting all the ones where it is a foregone conclusion. And in many towns, many cities, it is absolutely a foregone conclusion. The usual suspects are going to win, which discourages turnout. But the lower turnout is, then, and that turnout is also disproportionate. We know, especially in off-cycle elections, that homeowners are more likely to vote. City employees are more likely to vote. Parents with kids are more likely to vote because they have at least perceive themselves as having a larger stake. So they are disproportionate number of voters, and candidates amenable to their interest win, and candidates who might represent other interests don't have a chance.
I want to come back to that in a second, but Steve, political science professor Dr. Eric Heberlig at UNC Charlotte, a frequent guest on this program, says that people have questions over transparency in Charlotte city government, whether the government is spending their money appropriately. There's some level of controversy over money going into the Panther Stadium. And then, of course, there's the transportation tax referendum, which will be on the ballot in November. That wasn't on this ballot this time, but could these other issues have been driving people to the polls? Could that be one of the reasons why there was higher than the anticipated turnout?
Yeah, I think those issues are definitely part of why we had more people come vote this time. I think also there were at the, you know, the mayor's race was not competitive. The four at large seats were, there was really no excitement there, but there were some good races at the district level. In District 3, Tijuana Brown trying to win re-election while under federal indictment. There was a really close race in District 5 where J.D. Mesuera Arias beat an incumbent. That is extremely rare. There was a race in District 4, a Republican race in District 6. So I think you had some of these overall issues, but also at the primary level, there were some good races this year with a lot of back and forth.
So let's look at some of these individual races. The mayor's race, there's no question about the outcome here. Mayor Vi Lyle going for her, is going to probably get her fifth term in office, even though she will face a Republican in the November election. But she soundly beat everybody else by 75% in this race. No surprise there. Why does she have no significant competition?
You know, I think that Mayor Lyles is just going to be very hard to beat in a Democratic primary. It's just, there is a, no serious candidates oppose her. Now, I think it's worth noting in her previous three elections, where she's been the incumbent, she's won with 85% of the vote. Last night, she won with 71. That's still overwhelming support, but I mean, there was a little bit of a softening, and I think probably some of the issues we've talked about, the Panther Stadium, et cetera, did chip away a bit, but again, in no danger of losing.
So what will that mean in November? Because she'll be up against Republican Terry Donovan and Libertarian Rob Yates. I don't think they have a great deal of name recognition, but what will these misgivings that may have led to her decline in percentage point against fellow Democrats mean against other parties in November?
I suppose it could be slightly higher. You know, the opposition could get slightly higher. But in this city, only 19% of the registered voters are Republican. Almost half are Democrats and then unaffiliated the rest. That math just makes it really hard. I think the race to watch in November is the city council at large race. Could Edwin Peacock, a Republican, finish fourth and get one of the four seats? That's what he's hoping for. That'll be worth watching. But again, 19% of registered voters being a Republican. That's a tough place to start.
I know, Dr. John Lappe, you're sitting in New Hampshire and don't know much about Charlotte local politics, but you should know, and maybe you do know, that Charlotte-Mecklenburg is predominantly blue, and I think we only have two Republican elected officials on council and none on the Mecklenburg County Commission. And, of course, the mayor here is Democratic. And yet, there are some growing dissatisfaction with how the city of Charlotte, at least, is handling transparency issues. Do you think that voters understand the importance of these local elections to their personal lives? They tend to get more excited about who's running for president, maybe Senate, possibly governor. And yet, it would seem to me that the people on city council make the decisions that touch them the most.
Well, yeah, the decisions made in a city hall or town hall or the county courthouse have a more direct impact on your life than the decisions made in the state capitol or the national capitol in D.C. They're not the ones handling, you know, cleaning up the streets, paving the roads, educating your kids, policing, etc. That's all done at the local level. And it really is overlooked. Part of it is just that the more exciting issues are, that people perceive as the more exciting issues, tend to be handled at the state level and the federal level. That's what draws people into politics. The things that tend to divide us in our society the most usually are the least relevant at the local level, not so much in major cities, but especially in smaller towns, those issues just aren't really relevant. Like talking about abortion, for example, not really going to be relevant to policy in your average municipality. So people often don't perceive the importance of local elections. And, you know, the campaigns are also much less professional, especially in small towns. In a major city like Charlotte, you undoubtedly have more professional campaigning being done. But especially, you know, in small towns where it's usually the candidates are doing this part-time, bringing along their teenage sons to campaign for them. I had to do that back in the day, my hometown. So it's just a lot less awareness that the election is even going on.
Steve, the District 3 race got a lot of attention on city council, primarily because the incumbent, Tijuana Brown, is under federal indictment and because she failed to gain the endorsement of the Black Political Caucus, which went to her challenger, the person who won this race, Joy Mayo. There was also another Democrat running in that race, Warren Turner. Was this a surprise to people? Because it seems to me that Tijuana Brown, although she says she's innocent, she said she was going to continue to run despite the indictment, seemed to have a lot of support in the community. No one asked her any questions at town hall meetings about this indictment. So is this a surprise?
I don't think the fact that Joy Mayo won is a surprise. I think that her margin of victory is a bit, that I think that did catch people off guard. A lot of people in politics I spoke to thought the District 3 race would be a toss-up. And in fact, Joy Mayo almost got 50% in a four-person race, which is really high. Tijuana Brown only got 25%. So not a surprise that Councilmember Brown lost, but the size of the defeat is noteworthy.
And you were at Tijuana Brown headquarters last night. What was the mood there?
No, I was not. I was with Councilmember Brown. Oh, it's okay. I was with Councilmember Brown on Saturday during early voting at West Regional. I don't know if anyone has heard from Councilmember Brown since last night. Okay.
District 6 was the other race with a lot of people watching. This was the district formerly held by Republican City Councilman Tariq Bakari, who went to work for the Trump administration. He's no longer there, but he went to work there a few months ago. His wife, Krista, ran for the seat along with Sari Chakra. They're both Republicans. Neither has ever run for office before. Bakari has name recognition, and I guess that's reflected in the vote count, right?
Yeah, absolutely. She got 75% of the vote. Krista Bakari did run for a state House seat in 2024. So she has a little bit of familiarity with voters, or voters have familiarity with her. She will face Democrat Kimberly Owens in November. And this is the District 6 seat used to be solidly Republican. Now it's going to be, it's a toss-up seat.
And Tariq Bakari was a thorn in the mayor's side, and she kind of pricked the consciousness of many Democrats on city council. And Krista Bakari, who won the race last night in the primary, at least, did something very similar.
We have to stop looking at our council and voting just Democrats. And we have to put Republican voices on that council to make sure there is accountability, transparency, and that we are putting public safety first.
Okay. Is that what she's going to run on?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, yeah, absolutely. I think you'll hear a lot about public safety over the next 2 months, especially after what happened on the Leaks Blue Line. She will hammer home the idea of the city not being transparent. So yes, the Krista Bakari will be a very similar council. I mean, probably smooth off some of Tariq Bakari's rough edges, the core of the message will be very similar.
In District 1, incumbent Mayor Pro Tem Dante Anderson faced Charlene Henderson. In District 4, incumbent Renee Johnson faced Will Russell. District 5, incumbent Marjorie Molina went up against J.D. Missouri Arias. The winner of all three of these primary races automatically wins in November. The only upset, to my knowledge, correct me if I'm wrong, was Arias. He won in District 5, correct?
Yeah, that's right. This was the nastiest race on the ballot last night. It was a really contentious race, in part because of the airport vote earlier this year, when the city council and Marjorie Molina voted against studying, you know, ways to improve the working conditions and pay of airport workers.
And here's what Arias had to say after his victory.
I think our message resonated that this was a people-powered campaign rooted in love, honesty, and integrity, but most importantly, a deep love for East Charlotte that put people over profits.
Now, the margin of victory is tiny. It's like 37 votes. Is there likely to be a recount? Is he being premature here?
Councilmember Molina can request a recount. There are still 200 provisional ballots out citywide. So you divide that by seven, there's probably 25 or so in that district. But recounts usually don't change that much.
I wish I had more time, Professor Lappe, for your first time on this program, but this program has morphed and changed so many times over the last 24 hours that we are completely out of it. John Lappe is a professor of political science at Plymouth State University in New Hampshire. Earlier in the program, Spencer Ware, Meriwether, Mecklenburg County's district attorney, and of course, Steve Harrison, WFAE's political reporter. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.